We're continuing in our study on wisdom from Proverbs. And tonight I want to look at the topic of self-control. Now, the word itself does not appear often in Scripture. However, the idea is found all over the place. In the book of Proverbs, which is God's practical application of wisdom, it shows us what character looks like in the details of life and what it is to have character. And thus the actual word self-control appears only once in Proverbs, despite the fact that this is the book about wisdom and it talks much about self-control. But the teaching in Proverbs is full of exhortation to manifest self-control in specific situations, in certain circumstances, and it kind of unpacks it for us, so that instead of saying, in this situation, be self-controlling or act in self-control, it really tells us what self-control would look like. The one place where the word, the actual word for self-control appears is Proverbs 25 and verse 28. And it says, "Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls." So in my translation is the word self-control is translated as rule. Other translations, your English Standard Version, NIV, have self-control. So whoever has no self-control over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. So they're basically saying the same thing. He has no rule over his spirit, or he has no self-control. So whoever does not rule or restrain or control his own desires or actions is like a city that has no walls. Now it's hard for us to appreciate the comparison in this proverb. He who doesn't have self-control is like a city without walls, because we no longer live in walled cities. But back in biblical times, the city's walls were an integral part of one's protection and security. Protection not merely from foreign armies, but from gangs and thieves who would roam the countryside seeking to rape, pillage, and kidnap. You're very vulnerable to that kind of a thing unless you had walls around your dwelling. And such assaults didn't come when you were armed and ready for them, but they came when you least expected them and when you were least prepared. So the city wall was the first line of defense, and many a marauding gang would turn around at the walls of the city, realizing they were unable to gain access. They would bounce off the wall, so to speak, and seek some easier targets to assault. Because without that wall, armed men would be in your home before you even woke up, and that meant you were in a whole heap of trouble. So he who does not have control over himself or does not rule himself is an easy prey to sin, and it's important to realize that when the barrier of self-control has collapsed, the initiative is on the side of sin, for it to do whatever it wants, just like an invading army. Once it breaches the city walls, basically they do what they want. So when self-control is not functioning properly to hold back the enemy at the outset of the struggle, it cannot be relied upon to control sin once sin has gained the upper hand. So when the enemy breaches the wall, he has the upper hand in seeking to fulfill his desires, in seeking to accomplish his will. And likewise, when sin breaches the wall of self-control, in a sense our defenses have been exposed and are left incredibly vulnerable. At what point now do we then get the resolve, find the thing in order to protect and bring up, raise up the self-control? We have no defense, and basically at that point, sin can then take you into areas you never imagined possible, when you don't have that control. Once it's breached, just like once the enemy breaches the city wall, they're going to do things that you probably didn't imagine in your wildest dreams. And it's the same thing, the way sin operates in our lives. Self-control is the fruit of the Spirit, according to Galatians 5 and verse 23. That is not something that man conjures up by his own ability and strength. It is something that comes from God. However, having this from Him is tied to our relationship with Him, where we are casting ourselves upon Him. It revolves in this relationship of intimacy with Christ, trusting in Him, nurturing that relationship, and looking to Him to supply all that we need to love Him and obey Him. As Paul said to the Galatians in 5:16, "If you walk in the Spirit, you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh." So self-control is tied to an intimate relationship with Christ. When we do not nurture that relationship, we weaken our defenses, and thus, when sin finally breaches the wall, we are in no position to fight it, because we've withdrawn ourselves from communion with the Lord, or we've weakened the structure of that communion or that relationship. We are no longer seeking Him in prayer, we're no longer reading His Scriptures, we're no longer communicating with Him in our hearts about all things, we're no longer walking according to this truth, and seeking to live by every word from His mouth. And therefore, we are not walking in the Spirit. If you walk in the Spirit, you'll not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Walking in the confidence of our own strength and following the desires of our own hearts, that's what walking in the flesh is, when we walk according to those things, confident in our own strength. To live like this, of trusting in our strength, following our desires, is to have no walls. It's to have no self-control. It's to rely upon our own strength instead of relying upon the strength that is greater than us. Our wall of protection against the kingdom of darkness and all their assaults is found in Christ. And that provision is communion with Him. And He has told us what that communion looks like, what shape it takes, and how it is. So Proverbs, as we just read, Proverbs 25:28 is the only verse in Proverbs that uses the word self-control, that you could translate it straightforward like that. However, the principle of self-control is spelled out in numerous practical life examples. For example, Proverbs 23 verses 1 through 3, it says to us, "When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food." This is clearly talking about self-control. What is bribery? Bribery is basically acting contrary to principle for the purpose of gaining some benefit. You're hoping to receive something, and therefore you're going to act contrary to principle. And that's basically what's going on in this verse. The average person cannot imagine the amount of exotic dainties that powerful rulers have access to, the kind of parties and banquets that they have. I think it's hard for us to imagine that. We probably are in a slightly better position than the average person living in biblical times to the kings, but I think we still are very far removed from what transpires and goes down in these banquets that they put on. And it's no different for whether it's some third world dictator or whether it's a first world person caught up with all the dainties. I think they can throw these kinds of spreads. Thus, the person who is given to appetite will be amazed by the options and the unbelievable sight and taste of these dainties to the degree that he'll be unable or unaware of what is really going down. What is really taking place here? You can get sidetracked and mesmerized by the dainties. Now, you can extrapolate this out into many different areas. But if you picture that person viewing that situation, to caught up in the wonder of the occasion, where the food and the atmosphere can greatly impact discernment and resolve to stand on principle. It is a very powerful tool to do that. And Proverbs says, this food is deceptive. Now you have to ask, how can it be deceptive? Well, maybe the king said it was organic and it wasn't. I mean, maybe that's what's going down here. Or he said it was sugar-free and it wasn't. You know, maybe that's the real issue. I don't think so. The overwhelming splendor of the occasion is meant to stop you asking why you were invited to the banquet. Why was I invited to this banquet? Why am I on the guest list of this powerful leader? What does this leader want with me? And you say, well, don't ask such silly questions. I mean, that's the temptation. You know, this is amazing. I'll never have another opportunity to be in this kind of an environment. Why don't I make the most of it? Let me just eat to my heart's content and enjoy myself and just soak in the situation. But then you've already been deceived by the food. God says, put a knife to your throat, which is a graphic way of telling you to stand against the temptation. Similarly, as Jesus says, if your hand offends you, cut it off. It's that kind of language. To swallow all of these dainties is like ramming a knife into your throat. So rather slit your own throat than indulge in these dainties. It's basically what he's saying. Be assured that this ruler has an agenda. He's got an agenda that he has laid out, and he is seeking to sway you in some way for his own benefit. He doesn't just lay out banquets for people. So we mustn't be mesmerized by the dainties, mesmerized and enticed by what has been laid before us. After you've gorged yourself with much glee and praised the exotic spread and tantalized your taste buds beyond belief with all the oohs and the ahs and the wows and all that, and just being engulfed and submerged in that whole atmosphere and culture with the lights and the decor and the entertainment and everything else that might go along with such an occasion, and you've been overwhelmed by it, you'll be easy pickings for his agenda. Sometimes even just being at such a banquet fulfills the ruler's agenda. It's possible. Just your presence there has accomplished his goal. I had a similar situation. At a point coming up to the elections in Zimbabwe, the 2002 elections, Mugabe realized he was in trouble. And part of that trouble, he felt, was he wanted people to defend him on moral grounds. So he was reaching out to the pastors. And so he invited the pastors, and I was invited as well, to come and have a dinner in the capital with him. And he was going to address us, and he was going to just explain who he was and tell us, you know, his goals and his objectives and all those kinds of things. And then you'd have his media, because he's the only one who had the media. They would be covering it, and they would be presenting this ask, all these pastors sitting down and listening. It wasn't a dialogue you were going to have, it was a presentation. So he put on a fabulous banqueting meal, and I refused to go. Because just to stand with him would be to support his agenda and accomplish his goal, and as his media then would communicate, here he is, addressing all these pastors, sitting and listening to him. I believe that the principled stand was to not show up and let him speak to an empty hall, or just let the whole thing fall away, even if his media squashed the even existence of such an event, that, you know, it was never on the cards to happen. At least he couldn't use it as a promotional propaganda tool. But unfortunately, the hall was filled and everyone had a nice meal. And I knew some people who went, and they told me about it afterwards. But the reason the tactic is used is because it works. It works. Time and time again. Throughout the scriptures, right into our modern day, this tactic works. Where exotic banquets and fancy vacations sway people's emotions, sway people's hearts, and get them to act in a way that supports a different agenda than what they might have normally done. And it's something that constantly is used. Setting the occasion impacts one's emotions, which in turn can influence one's decisions. Self-control is a vital component of protection in such situations. Put a knife to your throat, because the danger of being seduced by the dainties is not only real but massive. And there are many different ways that this temptation can be brought across your path, because different things appeal to different people. And the wise seductor or seducer is going to be able to touch that button that you are most tempted by. When I was a kid, I was absolutely mesmerized by cruise ships. I mean, that was, to me, it was a dream that was beyond the most wildest fantasy. It was to be on a cruise ship with, I don't know, the little cabins and the swimming pools on top of a ship. I mean, it was just crazy, and the banquets and the food, and I can assure you, I would have done absolutely anything and agreed to absolutely anything if you promised me a week trip on a cruise liner. Now, before you get any ideas, that no longer is attractive to me, so don't even. But different ideas work in different ways with different people. Fundamental to self-control is principle. Principle trumping desires. And the more we practice standing upon principle, the more our desires will be brought into subjection. We can only do this with God's grace. But that doesn't mean the battle won't be intense at times, like needing to put a knife to one's throat. This is how intense it has to get, where you're saying, no, this is serious. Put a knife to your throat. When the knives come out, that's no fluffy battle you're involved in. And Scripture presents this mastery of self-control as one of the great battles to win. We're told that in another proverb, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. That's Proverbs 16 and verse 32. To rule oneself is central to the advancing of God's kingdom against the kingdom of darkness. We have recently seen in the news something that is common, namely men who have the grand plan to help nations, to help the United States, to help govern a nation. Yet they fail at this because they did not rule themselves. There was some failure in self-government that brings that to an end, or destroys that opportunity. Alexander the Great conquered the East, yet he had not subdued himself. And it's reported that someone said to this great conqueror, said to Alexander, you are a slave to those appetites over which I rule. So he had conquered the East, and yet he was a slave to certain appetites. He was incapable of conquering them. To have our eyes set on such great objectives, yet to fail to control ourselves is to fail. The battle to rule ourselves is unrelenting, because the flesh always lusts against the spirit, whereas the killing of Goliath is much easier, for once he's dead, he's dead, he's down and out. Whereas fighting against our flesh and our desires is trying to maintain the victory of our own desires is like a science fiction character that no matter how much you cut him in half or chop him up or defeat him or shoot him full of holes. He somehow pulls himself together again and comes back for another assault against you. You might have obliterated him into many, many pieces, but he mounts a fresh assault again after you think, well, I finally put that one down. We are to control our desires in all things, our tongues, our emotions, our anger, every aspect. As Proverbs says in Proverbs 20 verse 3, it is honorable for a man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel. See, now we're coming to self-control again. It's not telling us to be self-controlled, but it's teaching us what self-control is. The King James says that it's an honor for a man to cease from strife, but every fool will be meddling. See, it takes great self-control to hold your tongue, to not speak when you could deliver such a sweet blow to your opponent. That would be such a delicious shot to take. A fool can't control himself, and thus he has to say what's on his mind, even if it's going to spiral into a massive issue. This is not talking about cowering unto evil and not exposing what is wrong, but having the wisdom to realize the futility of being dragged into someone else's foolish quarrel. We need to do that, and then we need to have the self-discipline in order to hold our tongue at that point so we do not let something come out and enter into that fray. Even if you know the answer, if you've not been invited into the discussion, or if it's a contentious person who is sprouting it off, then you are better off controlling yourself and saying nothing. You see, because a contentious person, they're seeking strife. They want a battle. And they're not even looking for something that's logically consistent. They're not looking for an answer. But it's an honorable person who avoids strife. As James says, strife and confusion come from the kingdom of darkness. That's James 3 verses 14 through 16. And there are some people who, no matter how much you reason with them, will not see what is very obvious, because their objective is to create turmoil. And we're to be able to walk away from such barbs shooting out of their mouths. And it's not easy. Thus Proverbs says, it is an honor to do so. There's self-control. There's bringing flesh into subjection. There's holding down the pride. There's pushing down these things that so naturally rise up within us. It's a great honor to do that, which is part of what's meant in Proverbs 19:11 when it says, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. To receive the insult and not retaliate, since it is fools that are drawn into quarrels, shows that why this is honorable. We receive that and we endure that insult. We have to be able to overlook this insult, a transgression against us, overlook that. But we have to be ruling ourselves in order to do this. We need to be walking in the Spirit, not in the flesh. Because the flesh does not need much to be provoked. And a situation can quickly spiral out of control. It can quickly become unmanageable. As Proverbs 17 verse 14 says, the beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore stop contention before a quarrel starts. You see the spiral downwards into madness, when people no longer are able to reason rationally or according to justice. No matter how small the breach in a dam is, in that dam wall, and no matter how little the trickle begins, it will create a massive breach as it continues to run through that hole. Little fires and little leaks can become massively destructive forces. And each exchange of hurtful or insulting words widens the gap and moves the situation closer to an irredeemable position. So the contention that was brewed between Abraham and Lot's household was brought to a speedy end by the actions of Abraham demonstrating great self-control in Genesis 13 verses 8 and 9. He brought his flesh into subjection, the self-control there. So you have the very real natural tendencies. This was a very wealthy man, Abraham, with huge flocks that needed good pasture, needed good provision. And he realizes this land where they're at is too small for them, so he says to his brother-in-law, you take the best of the land. Despite the pressure that's still upon him to provide for his flocks and provide for his family, he put his flesh into subjection and gave the option for Lot to make the first choice. If Abraham was not ruling his spirit, if he was not bringing himself into subjection to what God's truth had revealed, basically the principle of preferring Lot even above himself, honoring others and regarding them as better than himself, it would be very difficult to apply the principle that Abraham did and said, no, you take the first choice. Then whatever's left, I'll make my existence on that. Proverbs 29 and verse 20 says, do you see a man hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Again, this requires self-control, not to speak too quickly. And in the context we are talking about, it's obvious that if we are going to avoid foolish quarrels, we need to stop things jumping out of our mouths before we have thought about the situation carefully. Even when you say something that is sound and accurate to a contentious person, a person who loves contention, he'll make an issue. He's going to make an issue of it. That's what he's going to do. Thus, how much more when you've spoken rashly and let something foolish or unwholesome come out of your mouth, and you've given him this arsenal or this weapon to use against you, or this amount of stuff to work with, because of our inability to control our mouths or inability to control ourselves, our pride, because your pride is hurt because of what he said or what he's done, and so there's no self-control in that sense. If we do not have self-control, strife will be inevitable. As Proverbs 30 and verse 33 says, "For as the churning of milk produces butter, and the wringing of the nose produces blood, so the force of wrath produces strife." You see, it's the fool who believes he can behave in an aggressive or inappropriate way and not create problems. It is the fool who either wants to or doesn't care about starting strife. I don't care where this goes. Let's just let it fall out how it's going to fall out. I don't care. That's not wisdom. That's not what we're called to do. It gets a point when you're in battle and you realize, okay, this is principle now, and now I'm not sure. We can't cross this line, and therefore let it go where it has to go. But that's something that is done carefully and calculated, and it's on principle, as opposed to the fool who says, I could care less. Let's just see what happens. But you have to have self-control, and we need to be controlling ourselves in order to arrive at that position. And that is according to principle rather than according to our offended pride or just a hot reaction. And the wise perceive where the path is headed and choose the way of humility and peace. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. So there you're giving a soft answer because you understand, you're perceiving and weighing up the situation and realizing, well, we're in a bit of trouble here, or this is where it could head to. But we see it's only through self-control and humility that we will not force wrath. To put down our pride, our flesh, and to seek a way of peace and building the kingdom, it requires great self-control. As the verse preceding this one of forcing wrath and the wringing of the nose, it says, if you have been foolish in exalting yourself, there's the pride, or if you have devised evil, put your hand on your mouth, cease speaking. That's Proverbs 30 verse 32. So cease speaking, because be assured, as surely as shaking around milk will produce butter, and you're going to wring somebody's nose, blood is going to come. So too, as you proclaim, if you do not control your tongue, you'll be forcing wrath and multiplying strife. So self-control is central to life in the kingdom. It's central to our own protection. It's central to the protection of our families, the protection of the circles as they go out from family to church and nation. But it's also, we see how vital it is in our own protection, and from that to the stepping to advancing of the kingdom. It's very vital in our battling of advancing the kingdom, which is having self-control. So are there any questions or comments with respect to self-control or illustrations? That's the moral strength. If that quote that I came across with about Alexander the Great is correct, it's amazing, is it not? The whole world is brought under his heel, and he could not bring his own appetites under his rule. Sobering.
Where you truly are relying on Christ.
Right. So how do you avoid relying upon your own strength, and what does truly relying upon Christ look like? It's a number of things that truly relying upon him looks like. It's vital to that is obviously where you fleeing to him. Okay, so that's something that you do within your whole attitude and heart, seeking his forgiveness, crying out even in desperation, Lord, help me, give me the strength to stand. I know what this principle is. Even give me the desire to stand. Sometimes I don't even have the desire to stand, but I know I need to. But then more practical on top of that is the way we set up and live our life. So we maintaining that communion, which is very practical in many ways. You know, we sometimes spiritualize communion with Christ into a mystical thing as opposed to our regular communing with him with devotion and praying and just being in constant contact and practicing that, being in his presence and living in His presence. My gauge is usually, you can see when your personal communion and life, spiritual life, kind of tapers down, you kind of find yourself in all kinds of struggles that are somehow, they seem bigger and greater than they used to be. So there's a very spiritual aspect to the battle, but there's also a very practical side of relying upon Him and feeding those things, being washed by the water of the Word, communing with Him. You know, as the psalmist talks about communing with Him on our beds, meditating upon Him in the night seasons. When I can't sleep, let me be praying, let me be interceding. When I have time to myself, be interceding. If I'm struggling with a sin, let me pray for somebody else who's might be struggling with the same sin or some other sin. You know, being very spiritually engaged in the battles, realizing this is a battle. And that's how I understand it. Then I'm really open to have some more contributions added. So there's a humility in the sense of, Lord, unless you save, I'm done for. But at the same time, you're feeding yourself spiritually through communing with Him.
A process that we're working with.
Right. All those things are both evidence in the life of the believer, and he's got to be growing in them all simultaneously. So it's not like you're moving from one to the next. So you're increasing in all those things simultaneously. We've got to constantly be fighting on all these different fronts. And they're all interrelated. You know, the way I turn the other cheek in a certain conflict is because of my love as well. So I'm growing in my love, my understanding. It's growing in my knowledge of what I'm trying to accomplish. So they're all, but there is a growth in understanding. And as we strengthen them, I believe we do stand better and we're able to fight better. The battle never ceases, but when we are strengthening ourselves in an area, I believe we will gain victory. Although it's never comprehensive in this life. So if you're struggling with some issue, it must not become overwhelming. It must not become the thing that, well, it's impossible. How do you ever deal with this? How do I ever escape from this sin? It's something that can be done by the grace and the power of God, and we start standing. We start pushing it back. Once again, crying out in desperation. It's not, Lord, woe is me. This is the greatest battle to ever win. It's the self-control battle. Not taking a city, not conquering the world, and God's dominion of the world through His people. Vital to that is the self-control of each believer as they do battle and gain the victory in their own lives. And it's from there that the greater victory is experienced throughout the kingdom. Right, it's absolutely vital for the next generation. When they're 50, they need to be way ahead, fighting other battles. Right. Well, let's spend some time in prayer and then we can continue fellowshipping.